You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France. Today we're at Grand Colombier.
Ian, we are reacting somewhat on the hoof to today's Tour de France stage because about an hour ago we thought we'd won the Tour de France. Such were our logistics. We were parked at the team buses. We finished our work. We knew that our hotel was about 10 or 11 kilometres away, straight down the main road. We got here in good time, but we've had some trouble checking in. I think Madame and Monsieur are slightly overwhelmed by the Tour de France descending on this hotel. We're on the kind of the evacuation route where all the team buses went past us about an hour ago. I think we feel a little bit like Jonas Vingegaard might be feeling this evening. This is our Stage 13 Tour de France episode. My name is Lionel Burney, and again, I'm joined by Ian Boswell, former World Tour professional, of course, podcaster as well. Breakfast with Boz is Ian's podcast, if you want to check that out after the Tour de France, of course, once you've listened to all the cycling podcast output from the tour. But Ian, what a stage.
It really was, and kind of, I mean, Vingegaard must feel like I felt trying to order these beers. 2 minutes plus 2 minutes plus 2 minutes adds up to me waiting for an hour to get two beers. And then they ran out of glasses, so we only have a small one. But we're finally kind of back in the high mountains. Wasn't here for the first week, and what a stage it was. Just one classified climb, but it was an exciting one.
A heck of a climb, and, well, it was all about the final 400 metres, wasn't it? So let's hear the details.
It's time for the tale of the attack.
It was short and explosive, wasn't it? 137.6 kilometres from Châtillon-sur-Chalaronne to Grand Colombier. As you say, and it was the climb at the end that everybody was waiting for. Baking hot again today, wasn't it? And we speculated yesterday about who might make it into the break. They wouldn't let the stellar climbers in, just in case. But there were some good climbing talent in that breakaway. Well, the stage winner was Michał Kwiatkowski of Team Ineos. But before that, the breakaway got into the bottom of the climb with about a four-minute advantage. And, I mean, I was pretty off the mark last night saying that they might need 10 minutes to make it all the way to the top. You actually said 4 minutes will be touch and go, perhaps, and 4 minutes was enough because on the climb it was Bastille Day, of course, today, and the French rider from Groupama FDJ, Quentin Pacher, was the first to go clear on the climb. So he had the lead of the Tour de France on Bastille Day, delighting the French. Behind Maxime Van Hiels of Lotto Destiny, James Shaw of EF Education, and Harold Tejada of Astana bridged up to him and then dropped Pacher. And then before we knew it, really, Michał Kwiatkowski made his move. Top quality climber, very dangerous presence in that breakaway group. And I mean, there were some cracking riders in there from the start. Kasper Asgreen, Matej Mohoric, Fred Wright, Jasper Stuyven, Georg Zimmermann, again, Ugo Uhl, stage winner last year, of course. But once Kwiatkowski was away, he really had it sewn up very early on. And then we could transfer our eyes to the GC race behind. And what an uneven race it was, because UAE Team Emirates had numbers in front of Tadej Pogacar as Jumbo-Visma kind of melted away in front of our eyes. Long way to go on the climb. And the yellow jersey, Jonas Vingegaard, had just Sepp Kuss and Dylan van Baarle for support. And then van Baarle was dropped. So Jumbo-Visma were significantly outnumbered. We'll talk about that in the next part. I was wondering whether Pogacar would go long or whether he'd wait. We were wondering whether the time bonus at the top of the climb would come into play. And really, Adam Yates of UAE threw in a bit of a curveball, making that acceleration with just over 2 kilometres to go, forcing Sepp Kuss to react. We'll debate whether or not Kuss needed to react at that point, and splitting the group down to really the biggest names in this Tour de France. And then with 400 metres to go, a very long, very powerful sprint by Tadej Pogacar. And he slowly cracked Jonas Vingegaard. And but for Maxime Van Hiels, he'd have had a few more seconds in bonuses. But Van Hiels held on for second place. Pogacar over the line in third. So he took 4 seconds on the road and 4 seconds in bonuses. So Vingegaard now leads by only 9 seconds. And, well, what's it like racing in that rarefied company? Let's hear from EF Education's man of the day, James Shaw. Remember, he was in the break on the day to Courtrai-Cambasque. And he finished sixth today after another brilliant ride in the mountains. And I think he sums it up perfectly.
Yeah, they're different gravy as well, aren't they? As they, you know, they're born different than boys. So for me, it's just quite an interesting thought to see how far behind I am.
The cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
As their chief executive Stephen Moon explains, Science in Sport's sponsorship of the Tour de l'Unsar is not one made for commercial reasons. They don't expect a great financial return or any financial return, but the aim is broader than that.
We initially sent off quite a large quantity of nutrition, and the race wasn't even in our minds right then. So we got some nutrition out because we thought it would help people learn how to ride longer distances. And we then started to understand the real challenge of the scene in Sierra Leone, you know, the whole concept of how you get things through customs and into the country. It became apparent that not only was this riding community riding on bad roads with bad kit, but also getting any kind of material through to them was not straightforward. So, in our usual Science in Sport way, being stubborn, we then doubled down and committed to get more and more nutrition and other bits of kit through to them. And it was a while after we got involved in the race.
Wherever you ride, on or off road, in whichever part of the world, Science in Sport has got the energy products to keep you going. They have everything you need for before, during and after your ride. Go to scienceinsport.com. James Shaw in perfect Nottinghamshire there. Different gravy, them lads, aren't they? And, well, Pogacar once again opening the door on Jonas Vingegaard and will presumably tonight be full of confidence ahead of another two very difficult days in the mountains. And I just wonder what's going through Vingegaard's head tonight.
Yeah, I mean, even when we pulled into the hotel, the UAE bus came rolling by us, honking the horn. Yeah, they're on cloud nine at the moment. I think this is really the perfect situation for them. You know, and when you look at the dominance of their team today, you know, they put in a big effort, but they didn't have to tear up the whole climb. And neither did Pogacar have to make an effort of, you know, a 5K attack where he's, you know, trying to get a bunch of time. He literally made an effort. Well, I mean, the whole climb's an effort, but for him, you know, it was 400 meters of him racing the final effort and taking that much time out and now only being 9 seconds behind. It's really a perfect situation. I mean, this is all he has to do. You know, he one stage win, and if Vingegaard's outside of the time bonuses, he's got the yellow jersey on his back.
Yeah, and I suppose we make a lot of it, don't we, when the deficit is so small, but the team doesn't have the pressure of supporting, defending the yellow jersey. They can very much let things happen around them. But today, they took it up, and they had so many riders there, didn't they? Michael Bjerg led into the bottom of the climb. He did a lot of work. Marc Soler, I mean, we had doubts about him as a team player when he was at Movistar, but he is absolutely dedicating himself to the cause here. Groschartner did another incredible turn, and then Rafał Majka, you know, sort of podium, Grand Tour podium style rider in his own right, took over. And then the Adam Yates attack. I mean, what did you think about that? It wasn't really necessary, but it really sort of put the cat among the pigeons. It meant that there was a kind of a tactical dimension to it, as well as just the ferocious pace that UAE were laying on.
Both Vingegaard and Pogacar have kind of a wingman, you know, in Sepp Kuss and Yates. You know, when Yates attacked, I was a little bit curious as to why Sepp went after him, because I don't necessarily think that he needed to jump on it. And I think that was, you know, almost a disadvantage for Vingegaard, because those efforts are what favor Pogacar and what really hurt Vingegaard. You know, he would prefer a longer, steadier climb, and he's still in the GC. You know, I think he's in sixth place, but he's 4+ minutes back. He's not going to take out 2 minutes in the last, you know, 2.5K on Pogacar and Vingegaard. So why did Sepp jump after that? I'm not really sure. And if anything, you know, I was thinking, okay, maybe if he gets a gap, then they want to close that right away, so Pogacar doesn't attack and have someone to jump across to. But I don't necessarily think it was necessary that Sepp Kuss closed that gap.
Will Jumbo-Visma be concerned about how strong UAE looked today? I mean, everyone did a very, very good and long turn. No, there were no real weak links in the chain.
I mean, they looked incredible today. I mean, that was what I noticed the most in the press room, was just how prominent they were on the front. And, you know, Sepp Kuss was there, you know, for the majority of the climb, but the last teammate outside of Sepp was Van Baarle, who, you know, is an incredibly strong rider, but on a climb like today, he's not going to be putting any pressure on Pogacar. And, you know, Wilco went out the back pretty early. Tiche Benoot, same. and they're not looking like the team that they were last year or even earlier in this race.
Let's hear a little bit from UAE Team Emirates manager Machin Fernandez talking at the finish today.
Well, the plan is perfect. In the moment of the remain five guy, in my opinion, with the 17 riders, is this perfect. After before of the whole thing, continue the same plan, is change the pace with the add an attack for try to the reaction of the Vingegaard and Kuss. Made the Kuss perfect reaction, for this is good, and take the 4 second and 4 second bonus day by day.
When a team's tails are up, everything goes to plan, doesn't it? He's saying there, that was the plan, taking it day by day, not getting carried away. You know, the Adam Yates move was the plan. Pogacar going with 400 metres to go was the plan. I suppose if Pogacar had gone from a bit further out, he might have gained a bit more time. But again, that's one of those things that the rider can only weigh up the scenario. And I just wonder the ferocity of the sprint, because from 400 metres to go, that is further than the bunch sprinters go from on the flat. I know the speeds are higher, but the power that must have taken to go that far out, open the door slowly, realise that Vingegaard was losing ground, and then sort of go again just to kind of finally just demoralise the Dane and give him no chance of getting back on the wheel, knowing that seconds on the line, they tick by pretty quickly, don't they? I mean, before you know it, 4 seconds, and then the other four in bonuses.
They do, and you know, when you see Pogacar attack, he's so ferocious. You know, I mean, he went, and Vingegaard can hold it for a few seconds. You know, he's on the wheel, and this is what happened the other day, and the gap just slowly goes, and Pogacar, you know, he did it again today. There's a second kick that he does, and when he does that, Vingegaard can't match it. And that's all he, you know, he's not chasing minutes. You know, I made the comment to you earlier today that outside of the Mary Blanc, he hasn't gained any time anywhere on Pogacar. Pogacar had one off day, or, you know, wasn't feeling it. But since then, he's put time into to Vingegaard every day. And you made a comment that, you know, Vingegaard was getting dropped and looked back. But what's he looking back for? You know, the race, he's following one rider, and the rider's in the white jersey ahead of you.
I think that's a real tell when a rider looks back when they're getting dropped, to see whether somebody might be coming that they could maybe flick the elbow and say, look, can you just do a turn, give them that little second or two of recovery. But Vingegaard and Pogacar are so far ahead of the others that when one isolates the other, the second place rider's really got no one else to turn to. They're on their own, and Vingegaard is leaking time alarmingly, little by little. And you do wonder whether this will lead to a kind of a definitive crack. And the next 2 days will answer that question. But you were at the Jumbo-Visma bus. What was the mood like around the bus this evening? Because UAE was all smiles and everyone was, you know, looking pretty happy with themselves.
It was pretty somber. Yeah, so Ryan Zaman, the team principal, he came over, and I was standing kind of between the Jumbo bus and the Ineos bus. You know, he came over and congratulated Rod. But then he just went into the corner and just kind of stood there. And I think he was just thinking, like, what are we going to do? You know, this is, you know, even more so than last year. You know, Vingegaard, the defending champion, they came in this year more knowledgeable, more experienced, more prepared for, you know, how do we manage having the yellow jersey in the Tour de France? I think he kind of feels it all slipping through his fingers.
It's funny, isn't it? When you look back to that first week and the way I think they thought they were going to crack Pogacar in 2 days, maybe take another minute, and then it would be very, very difficult for the Slovenian to get back into it, and it just hasn't worked out that way at all. And Pogacar's just looked like he's looking for those opportunities, waiting for those opportunities, and in a way, the fact that he's not yet in the yellow jersey keeps that hunger, that freshness, that kind of excitement going for him. He's not going to be there going, well, now I'm leading by 9 seconds and suddenly I'm the hunted. It's a really fascinating psychological battle as much as anything.
It is. And I do kind of wonder if Jumbo-Visma is wondering why they keep putting riders in breaks. I mean, Tiesch Benoot was in the break yesterday. You know, Van Aert was going for it, you know, on numerous occasions. And, you know, today wasn't necessarily a stage where there was one climb, that's it. You know, it wasn't like tomorrow where we have multiple days in the mountains, and, you know, Vingegaard was isolated. And are they questioning maybe burning a bit too many matches with the team in previous stages versus riding for a singular goal?
Well, just behind those two, there's a little bit of shaking up on the GC. Jai Hindley is, well, he's further away from the yellow jersey, but he's actually further ahead of the riders behind him. A very good day for the Aussie on the Bora Hansgrohe team, and this is what he had to say at the finish. Well, how do you assess that today? Happy with your performance?
Yeah, it was a pretty, like, explosive stage, super short. Yeah, tough final climb. Real punch at the end there. Happy to not lose so much time and also put time into the guys behind me on GC. So.
Yeah, we can see from the race for first and second, it's a race of seconds. At the moment, you've got a really nice advantage, and just to stretch that advantage even a little bit must be a big boost.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, if you can gain time wherever, then it's always good. And race is still a long way to go, but yeah, take time where I can get it.
And lastly, what about that pace from UAE Team Emirates? How is it hanging on to the back of that at the moment?
Pretty hard. All climbs now are just super fast. There's not so much tactics involved, I would say. It's like you have the legs or you don't, and that's that.
Well, I think we've kind of dug deep for a little bit of tactical sophistication in the UAE Team Emirates plan with the Adam Yates surprise move, because they could just have kept it all together, kept the pace really high and not upset the apple cart and then left Pogacar to do his thing. But Hindley there making the point that it's not really a tactical battle when it's that fast. It's just about who's got the legs, who can keep the pace long enough to stay in contention. I thought very impressive riding by Ineos Grenadiers, not just to win the stage, but to keep both Carlos Rodriguez and Tom Pidcock well in contention. We'll focus on them in the next part. Pau Bilbao slipped down a couple of places today, lost some time, which means both the Yates brothers move up. And Sepp Kuss and Thibaut Pinot are playing some kind of party game with 10th place at the moment. Sepp Kuss back into the top 10. Pinot has dropped down a bit. And that just shows the kind of madness of the Tour de France. All that effort yesterday by multiple teams to stop Pinot gaining time. And, well, he's given a little bit back today. But a real fascinating GC race developing here. And I mean, this is as close to a sort of dead heat as you can get in the Tour de France, with the penultimate weekend ahead of us and massive mountains to come. The Cycling Podcast is very proud to be supported by MAP. They made our brilliant Cycling Podcast jersey, and I asked a few days ago for listeners to send in pictures of yourselves, wearing the Cycling Podcast MAP jersey out on the road. And a good friend of the podcast, and in fact, good friend of mine, Laurent Audibert, who's a Frenchman but who lives in Watford, actual Watford, sent in a photo of himself riding on literally my home roads, within a couple of kilometres of my house. It made me feel slightly homesick for the moment when I saw the picture, but nevertheless, a very nice picture to see, Laurent. Thank you for that. And, well, we've been hearing from MAP's head of design, Harry Osborne, about the design process, all of the work that goes into making a MAP jersey distinctive, not just in the way that it looks, but in the way that it performs.
On a practical level, I think that means, you know, finding the perfect balance between creating a product that feels incredible to ride in, but equally pushes the sport forward. And you can see that through our, you know, our distinct use of colour. I think our evolving graphics, you know, the way we're bringing a fresh graphic language to the market, and also the way our products sort of, you know, fit on the body. So we're really looking at things across a wide spectrum of design aspects to bring a unique standpoint to the market, and also looking at things through the lens of, you know, how we can design products that support our customers' life around the bike. So whether that's through, you know, their road riding or their racing, you know, or whether they're adventuring, you know, further off the beaten track, and even their, you know, their daily life in the urban environment. So we're really trying to create a product range that can serve our customers across a wide spectrum of cycling disciplines, but rooted in performance.
Go to map.cc to check out the whole range of MAP clothing. They've actually just launched a new range as well. I'll perhaps talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, but you can also get the Cycling Podcast jersey at map.cc. Ineos Grenadiers won the day with Michał Kwiatkowski, his second Tour de France stage win in his career. The last one was in 2020 in the COVID Tour, when he and his teammate Richard Carapaz got away on a kind of lumpy stage, and the pair of them were a couple of minutes clear of everybody else, and they had this luxury situation of, well, does one gift the victory to the other, or do they sprint it out against each other? And they sprinted out against each other, and Kwiatkowski won on that occasion. A classy rider, isn't he? I mean, a very dangerous climber to allow in a break like that today.
He is dangerous. He's also experienced. I think when we, you know, where he made his move today, he wasn't in the initial three riders up the road with James Shaw, but he, you know, he rode it smart, calculated, and, you know, he took his opportunity, he hit him, and he never looked back. And, you know, he did have a big gap, you know, or the breakaway had a pretty big gap at the bottom of the climb, but by the end it wasn't, you know, I'm sure you saw him looking back, wondering if the riders were coming from behind. Kwiatkowski's a great guy. I was teammates with him for a number of years, spoke to him the other day, and, you know, he's been, you know, hunting for a stage win here on multiple occasions already. For him to get it here on a mountaintop finish, even more impressive.
And especially when they've got two riders in the top 10. We were wondering yesterday what AG2R were doing chasing so hard when, well, they weren't really making any inroads in the time gap. And we saw Ineos Grenadiers on the front as well, and they did take quite a bit of a chunk out of that time gap. This morning at the start, I asked their sports director, Steve Cummings, what they were actually doing and what their plans are for Rodriguez and Pidcock as the big mountains loom. First of all, Steve, could you explain why the Ineos team were chasing so hard for that period of the race yesterday?
The instruction was to just regulate the gap on Pino, because Pino is good, and when we asked them to do it, the gap was about 4.5 minutes, and you're never sure in the breakaway, you know, if they accelerate to the finish. And also they started pulling, I think, 2k from the top of the climb. It's always better to do the downhill as far forward as you can. We had the riders, we concentrated on them trying to get as far up the GC as we can, and we don't want to give riders as good as Thibaut Pinot any advantage, really. So we might as well use the resources we have.
You've got two riders there in the top 10. They seem to be quite different characters, not just on the bike but off the bike. What's the strategy now? Do you want to get both of them as high as possible in Paris, or is one going to take precedent over the other? What's the thinking at this stage?
I think for the team's objective is to get... Yeah, we prefer to have one on the podium than fourth and fifth, that's for sure. The challenge is, like, which one's stronger is really difficult. But what we can say at the moment is Carlos is a minute ahead. He's, you know, he's been top 10 in the Vuelta last year. And in terms of his performances, there's probably less variability in his performances. So, yeah, but at the same time, Tom, you don't know where the ceiling is. They're both young. So it's quite a difficult decision, and maybe it's a decision that we don't have to take. It will just transpire on the road, but certainly we've given them a plan and some guidance today on how they should react if the riders in front of them or behind who are GC threats are dropped. For sure we have to take advantage, so that's what we've done.
What's it been like with Tom, because he's such a flamboyant natural racer? We see it in cyclocross, mountain biking, last year on the stage to Alpe d'Huez. I mean, he's not a rider that wants to be sitting tight and riding in this controlled kind of way. So what sort of conversations are you having with him about how to race the Tour de France for GC? Because it's a new thing for him.
Not really, because he's an intelligent guy as well, and you don't want to take that away from him. You want him to race his bike, use his instincts and stuff like that. But there's a little bit here of biding his time on the GC, and he's so close as well, he hasn't got that freedom to go up the road. But yeah, he's always just trying to keep him alert and awake for the moments where he could make the difference in certain scenarios. So we go through that daily just to plant a seed in his mind, really, what could be possible in certain scenarios.
As a team, would you be happy for him to sort of take a risk and bump his head on the glass ceiling and at least find out where that lies for him, even if it meant losing places on GC, rather than riding just conservatively and finishing as high as possible? Would you like to see him take a risk in the final week?
Yeah, I think let's get today out. Today is quite straightforward in that sense, you know, you arrive at the climb, but then after today we can reassess again. But yeah, of course you want to see him, who knows where he'll be today at the end of the day, we don't know. So first we do today, and then we can analyse the situation and make a plan for coming, but that's what we need to do.
It's a really interesting conundrum, this, isn't it? Because as Steve says there, they would obviously prefer one rider on the podium and the other dropping out of contention overall than having fourth and fifth or fourth and seventh or whatever. And yet, on the other hand, if rumours are to be believed and Carlos Rodriguez is leaving to go to Movistar next season, you would expect, you know, Tom Pidcock going to be at Ineos Grenadiers for a while. He is the future of the team as things stand. It would be interesting to see just what Pidcock could achieve. I mean, today, fifth on the stage, the next rider after Pogacar and Vingegaard, a really impressive ride, and he's putting together a very solid GC, despite the fact that he's a much more flamboyant rider than that, really. Just the sort of staid, steady, careful, no risk GC style racing is not really his DNA, is it?
No, it's not. I met up with Rod Ellenworth after the stage to speak about this, and because I know that, you know, Pidcock's not a rider that tends to want to ride to the, you know, the typical and the traditional Team Sky strategy. So let's hear from Rod. Rod, Lionel was speaking to Steve this morning kind of about what the team's tactic is as far as GC. I mean, there's no question that Ineos is a bit in a transitional phase, but I guess what we saw today with for Pidcock and Carlos was that the team really rode like a kind of like old school Team Sky. You know, at the coming into the base of the climb, the team was there, and obviously, you know, congrats on the win, but as far as you know, kind of developing the next GC rider, is that still very much a goal here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, for them two younger guys, that's everything that we've wanted to do for them two. And I think, you know, Carlos is a bit of an easier one because he's on that sort of traditional Grand Tour, you know, long burn, if you like, you know. But Tom's very different. I think with his, you know, he's got other objectives with the mountain biking. I think he's just putting a toe in the water here at the Tour. And I think, you know, what we're seeing there for somebody who's just putting a toe in the water, he's coming up with the goods at the minute. And then, yeah, you know, we wanted, you know, put somebody in the big break. If it was a big break, if it was a small break, don't bother. But then really concentrate on how we bring them lads into the bottom of the climb. And also, we did a big thing on fuel, on cooling. So, you know, that last 40K, massive amount of cooling so that they, you know, could really sort of you know, maintain that temperature. Because holding that off was the key thing here today.
And Tom had an awesome ride today. I mean, he was up there with the best GC riders. Is it hard to convince him to ride GC? Because, I mean, he's a racer, you know, and I heard even after this he's going to mountain bike worlds, not the road worlds. Is it hard to convince him to see that him make that transition like Wiggins and Geraint made?
Well, I think it's just quite different. That's the thing. And I, you know, I've always believed you've got to follow riders' dreams and ambitions. And, you know, if you try and cut them short in that you don't get the best out of them. So I do believe what he's doing is right. He's doing everything well, and he wants to go for GC here. That's the thing at this race. You know, he wants to practice the GC. He's talked about doing all the basics well, you know, the recovery after the stage, the, you know, everything, the fueling, the cooling, the everything really well, and it's part of that process, I think.
And do you know how many stage wins this is for the Sky Ineos organization?
Haven't got a clue, no.
Do you have a guess?
I don't think we've won many stages, have we? I don't know, actually. In Grand Tours or in the Tour?
Just in the Tour.
Oh, do you want to have a clue? 10 maybe? I don't know.
Thanks, Rod.
How many is it? Do you know?
I don't know.
No, nor do I. I haven't got a clue. No, not a clue.
Well, we heard there from Rod, and he kind of said just that Pidcock is here to ride GC, and he's testing out the process. You know, we've heard this so many times from Team Sky. You know, it's a process. It's, you know, there's a strategy, and it's probably not easy for him to ride a little bit more conservative and, you know, waiting, being patient. But if he wants to see what he's capable of doing at a Grand Tour and at the Tour de France, he has to try that now. And is he going to win this year's Tour? No. But is this a good indication of can he be a, you know, a podium contender this year and potentially a Grand Tour winner down the road? He'll find that out at this Tour.
Yeah, it's interesting watching Ineos Grenadiers. I mean, lots of people have made this point that they're in a transitional phase. Quite a few of their sort of Grand Tour style support riders, or even, well, in the case of Theo Gegenhardt, a Grand Tour winner in the Giro a few years ago, are leaving. We think Theo Gegenhardt's going to Lidl Trek. Pavel Sivakov, we expect to move on somewhere else. So quite a changing of the guard there. And there's this real kind of strange situation at the moment where Vingegaard and Pogacar are on this sort of top shelf of Grand Tour talent. Remco Evenepoel, clearly a brilliant rider, won the Vuelta last year, may very well have gone close in the Giro this year before having to pull out with COVID. He's under lock and key at Sudal Quickstep, and there were lots of rumours that maybe Ineos would try and buy him out of the contract there and lure him across, because as high as the level is, there aren't very many riders that you can imagine challenging Vingegaard and Pogacar. And so Ineos Grenadiers have got this strange conundrum at the moment, haven't they? What are they building towards?
They do, but if you kind of look at these, you know, these superstars of this era, Pidcock is one of those riders. And, you know, I know we don't always consider him, you know, a pure climber, but, you know, how can he kind of change his characteristics over the next couple of years if he decides, you know, like Geraint Thomas, like Bradley Wiggins, you know, if I want to be a Grand Tour rider in you know, 2025, I want to win the Tour de France. I think he is capable of it. And I think a lot of, you know, I think time will also give him some maturity, and he will maybe be less inclined to go for, you know, cyclocross worlds or the mountain bike world championships. He may, you know, come to a point in his career where he decides, you know what, the Tour de France is the biggest event in cycling. I'm going to solely focus on that event.
What do you reckon? I mean, Evenepoel and Ineos is probably not going to happen, certainly not in the short term. I just have this feeling that in the Sky days, when the team was owned by, effectively by Sky, they would have broken the bank. You know, Dave Brailsford would have gone out and got his man. And Ineos isn't cut from quite the same cloth, it doesn't seem to me.
No, and we saw that today. You know, coming into the base of the climb, we saw two teams on the front. We saw UAE and we saw Team Ineos. You know, Jumbo wasn't even there. And you know, as Steve said, you know, they're in a mindset now of like, we need to develop our future Grand Tour winner. So we need our, you know, domestiques and our team to ride like we are holding the yellow jersey, because you need to practice that. And, you know, we saw that with Wiggins in 2011, 2012, that there's a process you go through to be a Grand Tour team and a Grand Tour rider. So is Pidcock that guy? I think that's what they're banking on, because there really aren't that many riders you can see going up against, you know, and Pogacar is young. You know, Vingegaard's a little bit older, but I mean, yeah, there's not many riders, and I don't see anything in the pipeline of someone coming up to really challenge that top tier of riders at the moment.
Yeah, that's a really good point about riding to the process. I mean, it sounds quite prosaic, quite boring, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, as Steve Cummings said, yesterday's plan was just to kind of hold that gap, not really take chunks out of it. But once they got on the front and they had the horsepower, they decided to use it. And as you say today, even though they had Kwiatkowski up the road in that break, who would have had his eyes on that stage win, they were lifting the pace to get Rodriguez and Pidcock into the bottom of the climb in a good position. And quite smart riding, really, to be able to play those two cards, come out with a stage win and preserve the overall positions of both Rodriguez and Pidcock. They'll be very happy tonight.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think it's also a matter of putting a little bit of pressure on Pidcock. You know, when he sees his teammates up there riding, you know, sacrificing, you know, their day for him, because if he wants to be a Grand Tour rider, that's what it's going to be. And I don't know him that well, but I assume if he is a rider who's a little bit more spontaneous, it's easy to flip that switch and be like, you know what, I started the climb 30 riders back and not feeling great. But when he sees his team up there riding like that for him, okay, I'm going to finish this off, because he's clearly capable of doing it.
That's another very good point, because cyclocross and mountain bike is real kind of individual cycling, isn't it? Whereas Grand Tour riding is all about the team. So we'll watch how that evolves. You asked Rod how many Grand Tour stages the Team Sky Ineos Grenadiers squad have won over the years. They, of course, made their debut in 2010. I mean, he's miles off. he should have a better grip on the numbers than this. But that would, I think, that was the 20th stage win by Team Sky Ineos. The very first was back in 2011. Edvald Boasenhagen won two stages that year. They, of course, drew a complete blank in their debut tour in 2010 and went home with their tails between their legs a little bit. And over the years, the most successful tour, 2012, when Mark Cavendish won three, Bradley Wiggins two, and Chris Froome one. And as I say, yeah, Kwiatkowski in 2020, Pidcock last year, and Kwiatkowski again today. Quite a collection of stage wins there. And when I look at it, it's interesting that, you know, Chris Froome won the tour all those years, but apart from 2013, he wasn't like a massive stage winner. You know, there was even 2017 when he won the tour without winning a stage. But there we are, a good day for Ineos Grenadiers. The other person that we were focusing on this morning at the start was Jack Haig of Bahrain Victorious, because I mean, he is a diesel, isn't he? He has been racing since the start of the Giro. In fact, he did the Tour of the Alps before the Giro, just to get ready for the Giro. And I've calculated, and again, I might be one or two out here, but in the last 70 days, he has raced on 41 of those days. The whole Giro, a week off between the Giro and the Dauphiné, then 3 weeks off until the Tour de France. So he's doing the Giro, Dauphiné, Tour de France, treble. And I mean, that's not something we see very many riders do at all these days.
No, it's not. I mean, remember when I was at Katusha speaking to to Eric Zabel and speaking about how many races, he used to do 100 plus race days a year. It was very common for riders to do a race multiple, sometimes twice a week, you know, jump in a one day race, do multiple grand tours. But the more we see the evolution of sports science, we see riders racing much less, more altitude camps, you know, more training camps and less racing. And Jack has kind of really thrown that out the window, and, you know, he'll finish this tour with, I don't know if you calculated how many race days he'll have after this tour, but I think it's six, maybe 70 plus race days.
Yeah, it's going to get up there, isn't it? And that's almost a season.
It is a season. And you know, we're here, you can't stop racing at the end of July, because that's a long time to take off and to train until January, when presumably he'd maybe do, you know, Tour Down Under or the Australian Nationals. So he has to, you know, his season's by no means over yet either.
Well, you spoke to him at the start this morning, so let's hear what he had to say about his epic road trip, albeit a supported one. He's not bikepacking, is he?
No. Well, Jack, you did the Giro, then you did the Dauphiné, and now you're here at the Tour. So, I mean, how are you holding up so far?
You also forget that I did Tour of the Alps just before the Giro as well. So I've had a pretty heavy race program. Yeah, I'm starting to feel it a little bit, I'm not going to lie. But in general, it's gone maybe better than I expected. I kind of expected already in Dauphiné to not be super. And the first 2 days of Dauphiné, I felt like crap. And then it slowly kind of just got a bit better and better. And then the idea of coming to the Tour de France sort of came about after Critérium Dauphiné. And I sort of said, I got nothing really to lose. I sort of come here and I see how it goes. And we had Peyo and Mikel for GC. And I sort of just wanted to try and look for the breakaways and have a good ride to help the two GC boys.
I mean, it's kind of an old school approach to cycling. I mean, when you look back in the day, you know, riders would do 120 race days a year. When you look at Tour of the Alps, Giro, Dauphiné, Tour, that's a whole season within the span of 2 months.
Yeah, I think I'll finish the Tour de France with 75 race days. And I think now maybe the guys are doing like 65 to 70 for the whole season, let alone finishing with 75 at the middle of the season. An old school approach, and I feel as though I haven't really done any training since maybe before Tour of the Alps. I did an altitude camp there, and after that I barely trained. Like after Dauphiné, I went on a holiday for a week with my family. I rode the bike maybe 2 or 3 days in that week, and then I went home. I did 1 week of kind of training, then I came to the Tour.
So would this be the end of your season? Or I mean, Vuelta's not that far away, you could skip some training.
Yeah, a lot of people have been joking with me that Tour of Poland, Burgos and Vuelta, they're sort of lining up just perfectly. And if I finish the Tour going well, it could be an option. I kind of hope I can have a bit of a rest after the Tour, but I think I need to keep racing. The team would probably like me to do San Sebastian, Germany, Canada, and then after that, maybe Lombardy. But I think we just need to wait and see until the end of the Tour.
And lastly, so many riders are putting so much emphasis on preparation for races now. We see GC riders race less than ever. Do you feel like it's affecting your performance? I mean, do you feel like you could still go for a stage here? I mean, we're kind of coming into your territory here with the mountains looming. How do you feel that your approach is different? And would you continue to do this in the future?
So I've got an interesting theory. I don't think coaching works and training works. I think by the time you get to, let's say, the 10-man long list for the Tour de France, in any team, you're such a genetic freak at that point that as long as you do the basic things right of training hard every now and then, resting every now and then, all the finer details and the way that coaching is done in professional cycling at the moment, I don't think the coaching makes the difference in the end. I think it's more like a bit genetics. Because, okay, you look at Tadej or Jonas, do you think they're better because they have better coaches, or you think they're better just because they're genetic freaks?
I mean, I think they're just better. Yeah. I mean, I could coach Tadej to Tour de France win, probably. But.
No, it's kind of like sort of the way that I feel after this kind of weird season now, that it doesn't seem to matter what I do, but I'm kind of more or less at my level. Okay, maybe I'm a tiny bit better, I'm a tiny bit worse, but it's a couple of percent we're talking here, and maybe that couple of percent, yeah, is the difference from being top five or winning and being top 10. But if you're not the leader of the team, I feel that percent doesn't make too much of a difference.
A couple of other bits of business from today, Ian, because although it was a great day for Ineos Grenadiers, they did lose a rider, Ben Turner. We'll find out what was up with him tomorrow. We don't know at this moment. And Caleb Ewan as well, Lotto Destiny lose their sprinter. All that talk a few days ago about how, you know, he might be coming better, looking for a stage win. He's obviously been struggling over the last few days, and he is out of the race. And the other thing that's pretty ominous for Nielsen Paulus is that Tadej Pogacar's taken a bit of a chunk out of his lead in the King of the Mountains competition. And the way things are going, Pogacar is going to be hoovering up points. You can imagine him taking the King of the Mountains jersey perhaps even before he gets the yellow jersey at this rate.
Yeah, I spoke to Tom Southam the other day outside the Team EF bus, and he was saying, I was asking him a bit about the KOM classification, because I feel like it's one of those classifications that you don't really fully understand where the points are accumulated. And he said that it's very well possible that whoever wins this classification could not even start at this. They could have had 0 points before yesterday's stage. Okay, Pogacar has already accumulated points. He'll continue to accumulate points. You know, we've seen this the last couple of years where oftentimes the winner of the Tour de France also wins the KOM jersey, and in Pogacar's case, potentially wins the white jersey as well. With some big days coming up, it's going to be hard for Nielsen to hang on to that polka dot jersey.
Kilometre Zero at the 2023 Tour de France is available for Friends of the Podcast subscribers. There's an archive of more than 100 special episodes with new ones released throughout the year, and an annual subscription costs about the same as buying a cup of coffee a month. If you want to, you can pay more. For the first time, you can also sign up with a monthly subscription, so if you just want to see what it's all about, that might be the best option for you. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, and once you've subscribed, you'll get an email with instructions for how to add the feed to your favourite podcast app in just a few clicks. Support the Cycling Podcast by becoming a friend of the podcast.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Really not too much to report from last night's dinner. It was fairly unfussy, wasn't it? We just had a pizza at a little restaurant by the side of the road there in Belleville en Beaujolais. We didn't indulge in the very fine local wine. We were feeling pretty tired after a long hot day and a late night the night before. Woke up this morning feeling absolutely fantastic after almost 9 hours of, well, broken sleep, admittedly, by this stage of the tour. You went off out on your bike as well this morning?
I did, yeah. I mean, I think we were both feeling the effects of our nice dinner and Mitch's send-off the other night. And, you know, you've been on the tour much longer than me. But once in a while, I think a night like that is very needed. And you do feel a bit, you know, we're in wine country. We didn't have any wine. We didn't have a fancy, you know, Francois gave us a recommendation for a nice restaurant, which would have meant, you know, another midnight, 1 a.m. dinner and bed. But in hindsight, very glad we took it easy and, yeah, got to bed on time.
And we were in wine country but also cycling country, because we were in the shadow of Mont Bruy, which has been on the race route of the Paris-Nice a few times. It was snowed off there, I think, in 2016. Did you actually get up to the top of that?
I didn't. I actually rode around the circumference of it this morning. But yes, I actually did see a Strava segment from 2016 Paris-Nice where we came through there, and I actually took a PR. So I was faster on my ride today than I was in the 2016 Paris-Nice.
Wow, you're going better now than when you were a pro rider, Ian. What about tomorrow's stage? Because it's an absolute humdinger, and, well, we expect fireworks, don't we?
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with this stage. I rode it just under a week ago at the Étape de Tour. It starts in Annemasse and finishes in Morzine Porte au Soleil. There are 5 categorized climbs. And I will say that the beginning section of this race, it starts with the Col de Saxel and then the Col de Creux and then the Col de Feu, coming very quick. Not quick succession. They're not the hardest climbs, but there's not much valley road between them. So I expect to see a strong breakaway. The stage is 151.8 kilometers. After that sequence of climbs, they hit the Col de Ramaz down in the valley, and then the final climb of the day up to the Col de Juplan before descending into Morzine.
It's going to be a great stage. I mean, I was trying to think of Tour de France's that have reached this stage of the race this finely poised. I mean, we remember the Contador Schleck battle, well, more than 10 years ago now, but there was always a sense that one would have the upper hand over the other. And the other one you mentioned was Andy Schleck and Cadel Evans. But because Evans was a stronger time trialist, we always suspected that Evans would win that tour. I'm thinking back to 2008 when I think on the second rest day, like 30 seconds separated the top five. I'll look that up and we'll talk about it in tomorrow's episode, maybe, but it was Sastre, Evans, Bernhard Kohl, who was later disqualified, Menchoff, Van der Velde, and one of the Schlecks, all really closely bunched together after 2 weeks of racing. But we've not seen a tour where two such evenly matched riders are so close together on GC at such a late stage in the race.
No, we haven't. And, you know, the jersey hasn't changed hands, but the psychological battle and the momentum has, well, you know, been favoring Pogacar. And, you know, another thing to mention on tomorrow's stage, there is a time bonus at the top of the Juplan tomorrow. You know, and that's, I think it's 8, 6, and 4. And then I believe another time bonus down at the finish in Morzin. So, I mean, this race is, it's a nail biter. With the stages, with the stage tomorrow, the stages we have this weekend or on Sunday, we could see a completely different race come the next rest day.
Yeah, Vingegaard has been losing time, a bit like he's been losing loose change down the back of the sofa. Another couple of euros gone today. We'll see what tomorrow brings. But it's Bastille Day, which the French actually call just July the 14th. We call it Bastille Day, the French national holiday. And, well, our very dear friend Francois Tomazeau has a Bastille Day tradition on the podcast. Before we hear from Francois, thank you very much, Ian. I'll see you tomorrow when we will be joined by Lizzie Banks, who, well, this is her home stage tomorrow because she lives not far from Annemasse. And she, of course, is the EF Education TIBCO SVB rider who has just finished the Giro d'Honneur. And she'll be joining us for our Tour de France coverage for a few days. But now over to the maestro, Francois Tomazeau.
Now for some French flavour with me, Francois Tomazeau.
Well, guys, it's been a tradition in the past Tour de France that I sing La Marseillaise, the national anthem, on Bastille Day on the podcast. So I realized it's been 2 years in succession that Ineos Grenadiers win the Bastille Day stage. Last year was Tom Pidcock and this year is Michał Kwiatkowski. As I absolutely can't sing La Marseillaise in Polish, I've decided I'll try to sing La Marseillaise in English. So it's a it's kind of a clumsy translation of the words, but that's the thing I found on the internet. And so here we go for La Marseillaise in English. In English, the Marseillaise. Come on, children of the fatherland, the day of glory has arrived. Against us tyrannies, bloody banner is raised. Bloody banner is raised. Can you hear in the countryside mooing those ferocious soldiers? They're coming right into our arms to cut the throats of our sons and our women. To arms, citizens, form your battalions. Let's march, let's march. Let an impure blood water our furrows. Water our furrows. Well, on this, since it's very, very hot, I suppose, on the Tour de France, I leave you guys to water your furrows and, well, talk soon.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.